Audi.
Welcome to episode 30 of the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand, a vicar's daughter from Belfast. Travel writer Anna Hart's adventurous spirit was ignited by a childhood in the back streets of Singapore and has been untamable ever since. She's seen Shakespearean scenes amid gorillas in Rwanda, lived as a digital nomad in Bali, New Zealand and California, been transformed or at least had a great haircut with white witches in LA, and has even been an ice road trucker, fueled not only by wanderlust but also just being downright miserable. When her life lacks adventure and sunshine, it's the truly adventurous Anna Hart.
You've come all the way from sunny Margate on the Kent coast to London for this interview and for a gig tonight. It wasn't just for me. I won't flatter myself that much. By way of Belfast, and I think people will know from your accent, although your accent's very, it's a very traveller accent, I would say, yeah. For good reason. So tell me, Anna Hart, what you do.
Okay, my name's Anna Hart. I'm a travel writer. I've been writing for magazines and newspapers like The Guardian, The Telegraph, Condé Nast Traveller, Stylist and Grazia for over 10 years. I really write across travel, culture, social trends, food, fashion. And I really firmly believe that actually writing broadly makes you better in every specific subject. So I would never want to strictly write about travel or just do hotel reviews. It's much more about what's going on in the world, what interests me in the world right now.
That is a dream job to many people. How did it come about?
Well, I was very lucky. I worked my ass off.
It's funny how those two are often connected, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although I'm sure there's plenty of people that work their asses off and don't get lucky anywhere.
Well. Yeah, absolutely. So. I always knew I wanted to be a writer. I worked at the university newspaper in Glasgow when I was a student, and was very, very fortunate to get a graduate traineeship that put me at FHM magazine down in London when I graduated. From FHM, I moved to the features desk at Grazia, and from the features desk at Grazia to the features desk at Stylist. And actually then I realised that I was happier as a writer rather than an editor. I'd been promoted out of doing what I really enjoyed doing, which was writing. So I left and went freelance, which was a tough decision. And one I doubted for just a few years, but it's really paid off. I love what I do. My week is full of surprises. I get to choose my own hours. They are long hours, but I do get to choose them. I get to work on the go. I get to incorporate travel with work. So I feel like I've built up a flexible, healthy lifestyle that really works for me.
And travel is in your blood because you moved to Singapore at a very young age.
That's right. The most important trip that I ever made wasn't even my choosing. My parents shipped the whole family from Belfast to Singapore when I was 5 years old. And we lived there for 7 years and then moved back to Belfast.
That must have been a little bit of a culture shock from Belfast to Singapore. I can think of many differences, but what stood out to you?
It sure was. Belfast in the 90s was not exactly an idyll. The troubles were still trundling on. There was a curfew. The news was pretty depressing and bleak every evening. There was no real investment. We had few cafes or bars. You know, actually getting a job as a teenager was really, really hard. So I'm actually quite grateful that I got to split that up and spend a few years in this high-octane Southeast Asian city. It's quite a schizophrenic upbringing, I guess, you know, two quite different cities to grow up in. But I'm really grateful that I feel as at home in Southeast Asia as I do in Europe. And that is such a gift that you have, I think, when you grow up in a different place.
Describe to me what it was first like in Singapore. Can you remember the sights and sounds and the smells? How did it feel?
I can remember just this wall of humidity and heat. It was, to me, it was like being in the glass house at a botanical garden, and I couldn't believe that was actually real, that was the air. But I really quickly fell in love with all of the sights and the smells and the sounds of Singapore. You know, I loved the sound of the traffic, the smell of street food, the colour, which was just phenomenal, like searing blue skies, really, really vibrant, like architecture. Singapore was just a complete onslaught to the senses, and I loved it.
So I'm guessing that, like me, you're an international schoolgirl, because my family uprooted us from the north of England, which was a A difficult place in many ways, a lovely place at the time. And I was seven when we moved to Spain.
To Spain,
In the south coast of Spain. And that was, Spain was a very different place then. It was a bit lawless and there were a lot of British criminals there, but a lot of corruption. And it was, but it was like, it was the most magical place in the world. But when I meet other international school kids, people seem to have a certain je ne sais quoi in common. And I mean that, you know, I feel a bit of a twat speaking in French, but a certain something, I can't put my finger on it, that's it, but something in common. Is I don't know if it's a confidence or it's a travel in the blood, it's just something.
I think it's fake confidence.
Yeah. Oh,
because,
God, absolutely.
Because what you didn't have was actual confidence, because you didn't really feel at home anywhere. But what we have become really good at doing, really adept, is faking confidence, you know, like making new friends, you know, being quite good and possibly a bit dazzling at the start. And so I recognize that in other international school kids as well. It's like, right, we never really felt at home anywhere, which meant we had to kind of make the entire world our home and, you know, make ourselves feel comfy in the world.
I think that's a very, very good point and a good way of seeing it. And it's almost different to like public school kids, although there's a lot of public school kids at private international schools because they're fee-paying schools, so you have to be able to, you know, scrimp and save or have something to do to, you know, to be able to afford it. But I think it is, there is a difference. And we certainly weren't from like a well-to-do background, but we were at school suddenly with everyone from the kids of ambassadors to bank robbers.
Yeah, it's a proper old mix, isn't it, in an international school. You're right, like kind of the kids of criminals, you know, people who'd had to kind of like flee under dubious circumstances,
exactly, but had a bit of spare cash to send their kids to a nice school.
A little vicar's daughter like myself, my father was he's a vicar and he was teaching at a Bible college out in Singapore, so that's what took us over there.
That's an incredible, so almost your missionaries in a way.
I suppose so.
And are you still religious?
No, I'm not.
Disappointment to you as
well? I don't have a faith. In all sorts of ways, Lisa.
I'm sure you're not at all.
I mean, of course, everyone disappoints their parents. No, but they, I mean, they would, yeah.
So you came back from Singapore and moved back to Northern Ireland.
That's right, yes.
Back, so that must have been another culture shock.
It was. I mean, I think I had mistakenly believed during my 7 years in Singapore that Northern Ireland would feel like home when we got there. And then it didn't. We had strange Australian-American hybrid accents. So, you know, we were immediate oddballs. The fact that I was really excited when I saw cows in the wild immediately marked me out as being like a bit of a dork and, you know, just someone not quite from the same street.
Wild cows.
Yeah, the wild cows.
Actually, they're a bit scary. I'm always scared when I see a field of cows. I mean, they're quite violent sometimes.
In Singapore, cows were in the zoo. We had there was a cow in the zoo, so that was the only place I'd really seen a cow. So actually, that was a culture shock, and, you know, those kind of few years weren't particularly easy, but to be honest, I think anyone who actually enjoys their teenage years at school is a complete sociopath. I mean, I just think...
Oh my God, that's me. I really enjoyed my days at school.
You weirdo.
Not because I was like a girly swat or, you know, teacher's pet or anything, but it was just great fun. But then I was in the sunshine on the Costa del Sol. We spent most of the time down the beach and everything. But I loved my teenage days at
school.
Did you? It was great fun, yeah.
Okay, well, that is okay. You might be just the exception that's proving the rule.
Or I might be a sociopath.
I have good times and bad times at school, and actually I did enjoy... There were times when times during my teenage years, which when I look back and think, gosh, you know, it's quite a cool little kid. But realistically as well, you know, you're finding yourself in your school years, and it is a time of like social anxiety and status anxiety and quite scary. So most of the people I know had a bit of a rough ride at some point during their school
that's
years.
Yeah, that's it. But that rough ride sometimes can be quite fun, can almost be what makes you.
I agree, absolutely.
So I know that you were very young when you went travelling then on your own, weren't you? Something like 17?
Yeah, my very first big adventure abroad. When I finished in school in Belfast, I was 17, and pretty much I didn't want to start university in Glasgow below the legal drinking age.
Yeah, too right.
I mean, I just thought, I do not want to do Freshers Week and start this amazing new like life for myself and not be able to go to the pub with my new mate.
Surely in Glasgow, like, it's obligatory to sort of drink from the age of two.
Kind of is, and Belfast too. But you know, for better or for worse, it was inconceivable to me that I could start my university career under the legal drinking age.
Totally.
So I took a year out and spent 6 months teaching English at a school in Warsaw.
Not the usual place that you expect a backpacker, or obviously weren't backpacking, but why Warsaw?
It was the only place left by the time I got round to applying. I think I got the choice of Poland or Hungary, and I chose Poland. It was also affordable. I worked for the first 6 months in an old people's home in Belfast to save up enough money to do the following 6 months in Warsaw. It was amazing. I mean, it gave me a lifelong love of Eastern Europe. I even loved the food, you know, I developed posh tastes in vodka that I then had to sustain through my student years. But yeah, I had a great time. That was my first real taste of independent living abroad.
I admire that. I don't know if you ever read, sort of probably around the same time, there was a book by a guy called William Sutcliffe called Are You Experienced?
Yeah, I've read it. It's great,
it was a brilliant one, but it was about all like the backpackers that go when they're 18 and they go off to India and they, you know, act like total wankers really. Yes. And, you know, try and assimilate, but they don't at all, and they stand out, and they come back and they've got dreads and tattoos, and you know, and then you've got to get a job and live back in the cold and everything. I love the fact that you just went study. I'm going to Warsaw.
I did, yeah. Went to, I mean, I couldn't have afforded to have done the backpacker thing then. That had to wait until after I graduated, and then I did the whole trotting around Southeast Asia, learning to dive in Koh Tao and in Bangkok, teaching English for a little bit in Chiang Mai, that sort of thing. That was amazing.
I love that you got to do it eventually.
I did
what you did and ended up not in Warsaw but in Belgium.
And oh, wow.
I tossed a coin the day I left university. I tossed a coin with my then boyfriend at the time, and it was heads we stay in Brighton for the summer, tails we go to Amsterdam tomorrow. And it was tails, and we literally did go to Amsterdam the next day. But it was because we were going to work and save and then do the whole around the world, you know, the obligatory whole around the world thing. Our parents couldn't afford to pay for us, and we managed to earn no money, save no money. We had about 10 months in Holland and Belgium, singing in bars for pittance, for free beer was pretty good. And people like in Amsterdam, they, if you got on the public transport like a tram with a guitar, they'd say, can you play that? And we're like, yeah. And they'd like say, okay, it's okay, you don't have to pay your ticket. So we got lots of free beer.
Oh,
but
nice.
We didn't manage to travel the world. And then just came back with the table between our legs, and never, I mean, managed to travel the world since, but in a series of holidays, or, you know, a month here, 3 months there, 3 months in Bangkok or whatever. And there's lots of different ways of traveling. And if you can't afford to do, you know, like the both of us did, if you can't afford to do that whole backpacker thing, you know, there's other ways of doing it a little bit later.
Absolutely. I think that's a really, really interesting area. I mean, there's so many different ways to make travel a big part of your life, because not everybody does have the option to, you know, to swan off for a gap year at the age of 19, you know, travel around South, Central and South America, you know, spending a fortune. I mean, that really is a good few grand. Not everybody has then, you know, as they get older, the sorts of careers that allow them to disappear for six weeks at a time. You know, people have families young, people have all sort of financial commitments too, even like emotional commitments and just other stuff going on. So I'm always interested to hear how, if travel is important to you, the different ways that we make it work, that we scratch that itch without it completely disrupting our lives or breaking the bank.
Well, you truly scratch that itch, and you've been to many, many places, but where particularly stands out for you? I have to say, as a travel professional myself, this question really annoys me, because I'm going to ask you, I don't want to ask you your favourite place, because I hate being asked that, because I really don't have one, so I make one up on the spot. So what one are you going to make up for me?
Exactly, I know.
Pick one out of a hat.
By far away, my standaway trip last year was gorilla tracking in Rwanda and Uganda. So for me, an amazing trip is partly a fascinating destination, but it's obviously also what you get to do there. And I'm a total wildlife nut, and I'm lucky enough to have been on a couple of different safaris over the years. But actually rummaging through the undergrowth in the Virunga mountain range, you know, for gorillas, and then sitting face to face with our kind of like our closest kind of primate ancestors was just profound and life-changing, and a trip that I'll never ever forget.
In what ways do you think it was life-changing?
Honestly, you learn so much about human nature by watching primates. I mean, there were times when I would watch the kind of how the whole kind of family would interact, and it was almost Shakespearean. You could kind of see, you know, scheming going on. You could see like lust and heartbreak and betrayal. And I mean, I've got quite an overactive imagination, but I just sat like, you know, weaving these personal scenarios, and I really did feel like I was sitting with cousins, like watching daily life as a gorilla play out and all of the melodrama that comes with it.
That sounds amazing. I love the fact that you're probably sitting there thinking, oh my god, this is like Romeo and Juliet, you know.
Yeah.
They're having like a massive family row here, and actually maybe they were just going off and getting their bananas for the day, but you're sitting there going like, right, that's it, you
know? I mean, I am a total romantic fool, so yes, I might have been sitting thinking, oh, it's just like Romeo and Juliet. And yeah, my travel companion Damien was like, they're just shagging.
Gorillas shagging has got to be one of the top 10 travel experiences that they should have on TripAdvisor, definitely. But you've written a book recently, released this year, and it's called Departures, and that's been about your travels. So tell me about the book.
Yes, writing Departures has been such a joy. Essentially, it's 13 different trips that I've been on that have changed my life. So it is my life story told through the trips that changed me. And there were a few reasons I wanted to write it. I mean, I love travel journalism. I mean, I'm lucky enough to write a lot about adventure travel and uncovering new city destinations. But there's so much that doesn't go into a travel article. And really, I think what we omit is the personal side. So it's what happens to you when you go to this place, you know. So I really wanted to write a book that kind of brought home, this is what happens to a typical 22-year-old woman when she puts herself in this surroundings, when you have a horrific breakup and you just disappear to Thailand, like this is what happens. And so it was really fun to get more personal and really probe, you know, what travel can do for us, how we can have adventures anywhere, really what we should be kind of seeking from our trips abroad, like how to kind of get maximum bang for buck, really, emotionally and psychologically.
What did happen when you went to Bangkok and you were 22 and you just had a terrible breakup?
Brilliant. I learned to dive, like, you know, danced at full moon parties with like cute Australian boys, pretty much came home like healed. So I really do believe that travel can be, you know, quite a powerful intervention. You know, if you are stuck in a rut or your heartbroken and you just can't see a way out. I mean, obviously proceed with caution, like, you know, leaving your friends and family particularly and heading off solo is, you know, isn't for the faint-hearted and possibly might not be the best thing to do. But for me, travel has never failed to fix me.
Have you ever felt vulnerable? I know you've done a lot of solo travel. Have you ever felt vulnerable as a solo female traveller?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel vulnerable as a solo female citizen of London. You know, I think vulnerability is something we all live with on a daily basis, and it would be strange, like, not to acknowledge it. The way we experience the world is absolutely different to the way men do. Even my morning run through a London park is different to the run that my husband has when he's not being catcalled. And so absolutely, when you travel, these things are brought much more sharply into relief. You know, there's times when you don't know if an area is good or safe. You don't know if you could turn to the left and that could be unsafe, and to the right and it's safe. So it's really important, obviously, to have your wits about you. I think rely on other people. In fact, the one lovely positive, I think, to feeling a bit more vulnerable as a solo female traveller is that it does force us to form bonds quickly. You know, it forces you to rely on other people. And that does mean asking a receptionist, okay, which way is safe? Which way should I go? Am I okay to go to this place on my own? Possibly even just striking up conversations with other women in a bar if you're there alone. And it's actually sometimes these little bonding moments that can really transform a trip. And perhaps if we felt safer and you just strode out and you were happy sitting in a pub on your own, you know, reading the newspaper, you'd be denied these actually quite lovely little moments of, you know, of bonding and connection.
It's those unexpected moments that make travel to me, the people that you meet. And even if you're in a couple, you know, when I've traveled with my then boyfriend, husband now, you know, when you go away, if there's two of you or if there's a group of you, I think it's really important to just strike up a random conversation with a stranger.
Absolutely.
In a bar, wherever you are, you know, over dinner, whatever, and you can have the most crazy. I've had some of my wildest nights out.
Yeah,
that way.
Yeah. I mean you're a true adventurer, so I can see that even a meal out is an opportunity for an adventure.
It
for
is
you.
And that's very true. But I'm not an adventurer in the sense that maybe you are as well. I'm a social adventurer.
Yeah,
I go out and I love to travel and experience new cultures, but I'm not whitewater rafting or trekking the pole on my own with a backpack. I'm not that sort of adventurer. I'm more likely to be found in, you know, the bars and talking to people and eating and drinking and that sort of thing. And you've done a lot of actual adventure travel, haven't you?
I have. So I'm lucky in that respect, and I love adventure travel. I've always been quite sporty and physical, and I love that buzz that you get from like pushing yourself physically, and I love the scenery as well that you get when you kind of really get off the beaten track. So So adventurous trips like driving the ice roads up through the Canadian Arctic. I mean, that's kind of a dream for me. I've already talked about gorilla trekking.
Have you done the ice treks?
Yes, yeah, I did. Yeah, I drove the Dempster Highway.
Did you? What was that like?
It was amazing. I mean, I had...
Is that the one from the TV program?
Yes, it's from Ice Road Trekkers.
Yes. Oh my God, you're an ice road trekker.
I'm an ice road trekker. I had just passed my driving test I had learned in Hackney. And this was obviously driving off a frozen riverbed in the Canadian Arctic in this massive SUV. And that was a completely new experience. Actually, much easier than driving in Hackney, I've got to say.
You know, it doesn't really matter if you're skid and hit snow. There's nothing to hit,
Just snow.
That must have been incredible.
So that really was. So I'm really lucky. I've had these just spectacular adventure experiences that I could never have afforded to do, really, if it wasn't my job. And I never lose sight of just how lucky I am. And I pinch myself and I phone my dad and I always say, Daddy, I am in Namibia. And he always says, you are in Namibia. And then he'll have some fact about Namibia. He'll obviously know a lot more about Namibia than I did. But it's one of my favourite things to do. And it's just this little moment of appreciation where I just think, check me out. I have got somewhere great. I am so lucky.
Where else have you been that's been a great adventure?
Oh, I mean, I would fight to keep the definition of adventure broad. I mean, I think it's a social adventure, like chatting to people in bars, you know, maybe like going running off to like a party or finding some dive bars with some strangers that you meet in a bar in Madrid. Absolutely an adventure. And I think we should resist the idea that an adventure has to mean going very far for a very long time under arduous conditions. And that's quite a macho, blokey definition of adventure, which I think we've kind of absorbed from TV, like big kind of adventure shows like recently, all of kind of Ray Mears kind of stuff. But actually, I firmly believe that you can have an adventure in your daily life. You know, adventure is just pushing yourself. You know, it's anything that quickens the pulse, anything that just takes you out of the everyday. And so it can be social, it can be personal, it can be what happens to you psychologically, the way you think about something. That can happen in an art gallery. You can go on an emotional adventure. And I would really argue for keeping our notion of adventure broad.
I love that. Everyday adventures. And that's what often weekends are like to many of us, even if you can't afford to, you know, travel abroad, to have those adventures in your own town, to go to the big parks, to explore, to hang out in the pub. Doing that, but you know, whatever floats your boat, but to go and have those everyday adventures. And now another thing I read about you, and I think this is very interesting to people, is that you've spent time as a digital nomad. You've been digital nomading. I'm making that up now. I don't know if digital nomading is actually an adjective or is that verb? I can't remember. Writers here.
Those terrible international skills.
Yeah, exactly.
No grammar.
God, can you believe we pay for those as well? I don't know if digital nomading is a thing. I'm going to call it a thing because everything is a thing these days.
Yeah.
Whether it's a verb, I'm really embarrassed. Or an adjective. Oh, I'm really embarrassed now. I have to cut it out. I read this article that you said that you spent time in, you know, a month in LA when you're just working there. I think living out of a camper van in New Zealand when you're working there, on a beach in Bali when you're working there.
Yeah.
Tell me about this whole digital nomading.
So a few years ago, when I left my lovely job as features editor at Stylist, I knew that travel needed to be quite a big part of my life. For the previous few years, I'd really struggled with seasonal depression during the winter months. I'd ended up on antidepressants pretty consistently every winter. And one of the reasons that I went freelance was I just knew that if I could base myself somewhere sunny for between 4 weeks and a couple of months every winter, I could possibly stay off the meds. So that was a major reason why I started to look into this. It also mattered to me that I wasn't like expending jet fuel and time and energy and going somewhere for a couple of days and cutting that short. Money was also a major factor. I couldn't really afford to just like travel the world without working. And really it was those kind of three factors. It was a mixture of like lifestyle, money, and then also just wanting to be more of an ethical consumer and travel more sustainably, but being a bit more eco-minded. That made me realise I wanted to travel to places, stay there for a bit longer, work while I was there, really immerse myself in the culture, make some friends, have daily routines like a coffee shop I would work in or even some time at a co-working space. And I just found that a much more rewarding way to travel. So instead of going to Barcelona for a kind of expensive weekend at a hotel, I would get an Airbnb, I would stay there for 3 weeks, I would work in a co-working space. And so I'd be able to fund my travel and kind of live the life of a local. And I honestly soon realised I preferred that to the idea of a weekend at a hotel in that town.
It's such an amazing thing to do, but also such a luxury, because a lot of people have jobs, you know, that aren't freelance, and I'm freelance like you, and I'm sodding off to Spain for 6 weeks soon, and I will Yay. Be working there exactly the same yes. as, you know, I'm working here. People who I work with won't really notice any difference. You
yes.
know? But it's such a luxury to be able to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, I realise that my job, you know, it doesn't pay particularly well.
No, that's the thing. When yes. I say luxury, it's not the most well-paid yes. job in the world. But there's other, like we were saying, there's other ways of judging adventure. There's other ways of judging income and value, isn't there, than money.
Absolutely. And so while journalism doesn't pay particularly well, freedom is an asset that I absolutely have. And I really felt like I could maximise that. I could really capitalise on that by paying for the flight to base myself in LA, but then working there for 6 weeks to 8 weeks, writing hopefully a travel story about LA, but then also doing things like immersing myself in the modern mystic scene, writing about that for Condé Nast Traveler.
Tell me about the modern mystic scene
In LA. Yeah. Oh, amazing. There's all sorts of hipster witches in LA. I have hung out with them. Crystal healers, there's shamans. I mean, people in LA have shamans the way people in New York have therapists.
Oh my God, I've been to LA loads of times. My brother lives in LA. He does. I don't think he's got a shaman. I mean, what's wrong with
what
him?
What is wrong with him?
I don't know. I have to
ask
him.
No, that is so East Coast of him.
What does a shaman do? Apart from that song years ago, that sort of it's pilled up so album from the rave years.
It's spiritual healing. So in LA, I had a chakra cleanse combined with a haircut, which actually sounds a little bit wacky. And before it, I really wasn't convinced, but the stylist actually just blew me away. She said, well, when women come in and sit down for a haircut, they don't just want a little bit off the ends, they want a transformation, and they are quite often marking a transition. It could be a new job, it could be a new relationship, the end of an old relationship, they could be excited about a new season. And she was like, I actually just wanted to build it into more of a ritual, where as well as changing your physical appearance, you think about what changes you want inside and have a bit of a massage and cleanse. And I just couldn't really knock it. It worked. And I just, you know, in her words, she felt like she was only doing half the job if she just gave someone a haircut. She's like, the full job is being like, right, what do you want this? What do you want this to signal?
Oh,
what are you saying
God,
goodbye
what did
to?
Your hair, what did your hair look like after it?
I mean, my hair looked great. She's like a really, really good stylist. But I did also feel a little bit lighter and more carefree. You know, I talked about what was going on in my life. I was, you know, spoke about, you know, how I wanted hair that made me like look a bit more like Ygritte from Game of Thrones, because I wanted to feel more warrior-like. So it was an awful lot of fun.
You have good hair as well, I have to say.
Thank you.
But also, I think if someone paid me that much attention when I sat down, I think I'd probably burst into tears.
Oh, you know, honey! Like,
just to have that attention.
We got to get you to LA.
To get
a chakra cleanse, shamanic haircut. I'm going to hook you up with some white witches next time you go.
Oh my God, nobody's ever hooked me up with any white witches before. It's going to be brilliant. In the meantime, I'll get my brother to go there and see what hair, whether he comes out looking like a warrior.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, warrior haircut.
And where else have you enjoyed spending a big chunk of time like that as a digital nomad?
So I also spent a couple of months in Ubud in Bali. Ubud is a bamboo co-working space in Ubud, which is actually a real hub for digital nomads. I'd been working at a co-working space in Hackney. It was November, it was cold and miserable, and I pretty much just did a desk swap, you know. So I spent 6 weeks out in Ubud, getting up, doing my kind of like yoga there, working all day again. So I didn't really miss a beat. So I really, my trip had only cost me the airfare. And that's really key for me being as a digital nomad, is if you can't afford a holiday, which I've actually never really been able to do in quite a long time. You know, the idea of taking a week entirely off work is quite hard for me to conceive of. But I can afford to change my circumstances. I can afford to at least change the surroundings and work somewhere different.
On a practical level, are you still paying a rent or mortgage back home? Aren't you doubling up on that in a way?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I mean, I should probably look into Airbnb being my flat, but I've never been that organised.
No, and
or
then you
tidy.
Have to, I thought about that as well.
I'd
and then
have
you
to
have to tidy
tidying.
Yeah, I can't. When you work
and
from
I have
home,
a cat
I just
and
live
it's
in
just
a dump.
Confusing. Yeah.
But it is something to, a lot of people do, don't they?
Absolutely. I think that's the smart way to do it.
And there's so many, Airbnb and things like that have changed travel for so many people. And
absolutely.
Instagram as well. You know, well, if you believe what you see about people traveling on Instagram, you know, the whole world is sort of out there digital nomading it up in places.
I mean, the whole digital nomad lifestyle is a really, really mixed bag. And I do think it's important to bear that in mind. I mean, the term does specifically refer to people who are working elsewhere, so it's the pictures might be of them on, you know, at a yoga class or on the beach, but ultimately they're working long days there. I absolutely messed up my work-life balance in Ubud as well. The time difference meant that I was still getting emails from back home at 11 o'clock at night, so I could still be getting stressful emails from an editor at 11 p.m which is obviously not the kind of tropical relaxed zen yoga dream. So it's completely possible to be a digital nomad and still have those stresses and strains and still be knackered and still have a completely bad day in the office, even though you're surrounded by palm trees.
And I think you have to bear in mind, and you know, they talk about social media making people a bit miserable because you get that whole sort of fear of missing out sort of thing, that everyone's having this fabulous life, but you have to be aware that they're showing you their edited highlights, and actually, like you, you might be posting a beautiful photo of being in Bali, but you're escaping Hackney because you're pretty depressed and you want to go somewhere for some sunshine, and you're not a Bitcoin millionaire, sadly.
Yes, exactly.
You're a travel writer.
I mean, I certainly feel that social media is a real double-edged sword when it comes to travel. In some ways, it has completely revolutionised travel and made some really positive changes to the industry. See, as you'd know, it can be a phenomenally affordable and effective way for a small independent tour operator or little boutique hotel or bungalow to promote themselves. And that's amazing. I mean, that really does just distribute wealth and tourists back. And I really, really believe in that. Little unknown destinations can also suddenly be kind of flagged up if a, you know, all you need is like some huge influencer to go there on a holiday, and it's suddenly huge, and they haven't had to spend millions on a huge advertising campaign. So in some ways, I think it's really leveled the playing field and made things a lot fairer for independent and lesser known destinations and hotels. But then the whole kind of travel, the whole showy side of it all, and the pressure to be having the most amazing time ever, and the pressure to be documenting everything rather than actually focusing on what you're enjoying. I mean, I think that's really poisonous, and I think we really need to be careful there.
And a bit Black Mirror-y, people do judge each other by how many followers they got. And I find that myself doing it to other people in a way sometimes, but I kind of, you know, I was on TV and radio and writing and just poodling along just on Facebook, enjoying social media, chatting to my mates. I wasn't really, you know, doing anything with my Twitter account. I wasn't on Instagram. And I've turned around now that I'm doing the podcast and thought, oh shit, maybe it'd actually been good for me to be building up this big Twitter presence, because I've been in the public eye for a long time now, but haven't built it because I haven't worked on it or Instagram. And then actually these people are, you know, have got these businesses, you know, that they're running from
off
their phones.
Personally, I feel like it's a bit of a house of cards, and I think it might all fall down quite soon. I mean, I certainly know a lot of really, really savvy, like woke teenagers who just think Instagram and Facebook, you know, are the naffest things of all time and wouldn't dream of being on them. And they give me hope for the future.
Because if you're a massive influencer and all you've got is this, I say all, it's doing pretty well at the moment, but all you've got is this one Instagram account that you've got, you know, several hundred thousand or more followers on there. If people move away from that, you don't have your public persona. You know, you're not a writer, you're not a journalist, you're not out there doing it, you know, unless you've sort of set something else up, like a book or a tour or a radio show or whatever. You know, you don't actually have other work to back it up. That's why it's quite good to have a lot of fingers in
a lot of pies.
Yeah. A few episodes ago, I interviewed Simon Calder, and he's a travel expert. For those of you, this is a very international podcast. We've got listeners in about 80 countries all over the world. So if people don't know him, listen to him. He's a few episodes ago, and he's brilliant. He's probably the best travel expert in the UK. Nice gentleman, I'd say.
Yes.
And his message for me at the end, or for everyone at the end, was, don't think this is a dangerous time to travel. This is one of the safest times to travel. Mm-hmm. We are blessed with great technology, with great communication. Even though some people seem to get a sense that travel is getting a little bit dangerous, it's actually one of the best and most safest time in history to travel.
Yeah.
Do you concur with that?
I absolutely do. I am a complete wide-eyed hippie about travel. I feel that travel has the power to transform the travellers, and it has the power to transform us. But I also feel that really responsibly executed travel has the power to change the world. You know, if we can get travellers, the right travellers, to the right places with the right attitudes, it can foster understanding between different cultures. We can distribute wealth into places where it's desperately needed. And I really, really do believe in the power of travel for good when it's managed well. And I would also add to that now is a phenomenally safe time to travel solo as well. And I'm a big believer in solo travel. In fact, a recent survey found that something like 60% of Brits travel solo, even if they have a partner. And some 43% of solo travellers are married.
That's a really interesting statistic.
It really is. It was, a Travelzoo survey a few weeks ago. And really what that says is that, I think it says incredibly positive things about relationships and about travel, which is that, you know, we're not mistrustful lovers anymore. We accept that actually we're individuals with different needs. But also it really illustrates that we're becoming so much more fussy and thoughtful and mindful about the travel that we need. And so perhaps one of us wants a kayaking trip, the other one literally just wants to I want to lie on a beach reading a book, and we're willing to kind of give each other the leeway to do that. So I think it's a really exciting time for solo travel, where it is by no means a plan B. In fact, for a lot of people now, it is their chosen way to travel.
And if you are going anywhere, solo or otherwise, we should buy your book. Give us a plug for the book before we go.
Absolutely. My book is called Departures, A Guide to Letting Go, One Adventure at a Time. And the audiobook has just been recorded, and it's me. I had to audition to do my own audiobook, but I had to audition as me.
You've got such a beautiful voice.
Well, thank you. I think so too, but I got the part.
Great. My last question then is always about music, because music and travel always goes hand in hand. You've got more time to listen and might not be stuck in front of the telly or commuting or whatever. And if you could pinpoint just one song that reminds you of a time and special moment or memorable moment, it doesn't have to be your favourite band or anything like that, but a really great, special, wonderful, memorable moment of travel, what would that song be and why?
It's a song called Rome by the B-52s. And when I left my husband and went off to LA on my own for 6 months, that was playing my ears, and it really made me feel stronger and more fun-loving and just a little bit wilder. It has a great beat. It's impossible to be sad to that song, and that song saved me a lot of tears.
That's a great way to end it, but I kind of want to ask you more.
Sure,
your husband for 6 months. That's really hard.
I left him forever.
Oh, you left him forever, okay. Oh, that's not so hard. If it was like you needed to leave him forever, no, that's not so hard.
I left him forever and went to LA.
Sorry about that.
No,
husband,
no, no.
You know?
No,
just in case the husband's listening, the ex-husband is listening.
Yeah.
You know, we're still very cut up about it, aren't we?
Yeah, of course. I am.
Oh, I see. That makes total sense. That makes total sense. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast. That was a blast. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. This has been really fun.
Thank you so much, Anna. We wish you all the best in your future travels and, of course, in sunny Margate. Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Join us for a brand new episode every Tuesday.